After 120 plus episodes of Develop Mentor, I finally have the opportunity to interview someone who is in the very role that inspired this show in the first place, the creative director. All the way back in episode one, I talked about how my son inspired this show through his love of both art and technology, and how that led me to wanting to showcase all the different ways people can participate in tech. Today's guest, Philip Noyad, has indeed combined a love of art and tech to build a successful career as a creative director. But of course, as with all of our guests, there is more to the story. Philip started his journey by earning a degree in East Asian Studies from Hanlin University before living in Japan for a number of years, working as a communications specialist while studying Japanese and honing his artistic side. Since returning to the United States and joining the tech revolution in the early 90s, he has helped companies like Fingerhut, Schwann's, Harlan Clark, Caring Bridge, and Target establish and grow online presences with a deep focus on user experience and usability. He has also, along his path, developed and grown as an artist, combining the physical and digital, including virtual reality, into a deep and rich portfolio at the cutting edge of modern art. I, of course, would also be violating my Minnesota heritage if I didn't mention that at one point in his career, he worked as a production assistant on Prince's Purple Rain movie. So be sure to stay tuned as we examine how Philip Noyad built a career in tech without giving up his love of art.
You're listening to the Develop Mentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Hey, Philip, welcome to Develop Mentor. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, Grant. Great to be here. Thank you.
Now, we were chatting offline, a good fellow Minnesotan here. I believe we met 3 to 4 years ago. Is that right?
Yes, you were speaking on search, and I went to listen and learn about that.
Yeah, and I remember even at that time you were starting to grow on, or you were pretty still deep in the art side of your work as well, right?
Yes. You know, around that time, I was doing light installations, and I participated in Northern Spark. I made a rainbow pyramid that was 20 feet by 20 feet that people could go inside of. And then soon after that, I was commissioned to do some artwork for the airport in Minneapolis-St. Paul.
That's fantastic. I've been through that airport probably more times than I care to remember at this point. But I do know they have a great support of artists there at the airport. So that's really fantastic you were able to participate.
Yes, absolutely. You know, part of the interesting aspect of creating public art is creating something that's iconographic and also is memorable and accessible for anybody of any age. And so that was a great challenge. And I feel like I was able to do that. It's been wonderful to have friends and family take pictures in front of my artwork and send them to me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And of course, I want to dive into the art part here when we, you know, in a bit later. And of course, we'll link up so people can, who are listening, can check out your art because there's some really amazing stuff here.
Yep.
But I want to go back a little bit. And, you know, naturally, I want to get to the tech side and I want to get to what it means to be a creative director and a modern artist, especially an artist who combines tech with the physical world. But I wanted to first have you set the stage for us a bit more by taking us back to the early years of your career or graduating college when you were at Hamlin and going off to Japan. And have you fill us in a little bit on the backstory there about how you were thinking about your career and your life at that time, what led you into East Asian studies and led you into going off to Japan?
Well, I grew up in St. Paul and I was studying on my own photography and filmmaking, and I was always very fascinated in those technologies. And I also had a deep appreciation of Zen and Japanese philosophy. And there was just a program available through Hamline to be an exchange student. And so I leapt at the opportunity and went to Japan as an exchange student and dove right into making pottery and studying calligraphy. And that was really very exciting to me because it was a art that had been around for years and years. And then for me to be able to do it was an amazing thing. I came back to America, to Hamline, and I'd used up all my art credits, and I was crestfallen because I wanted to study art. And if I had changed my major, I would have had to go to school longer. So I started going to school at night and studying filmmaking and photography. And then I stayed in the East Asian Studies program during the day. So I think that that kind of started my ability to like do a day thing, like studying the prescribed plan, but then also do a night thing where I'm doing filmmaking and photography.
Well, so tell me a little bit more then. So you graduate Hamline, and at some point you go back to Japan. I know you know, I mentioned the Prince thing in there as well. You know, kind of fill me in on, I guess, what is, looking at your profile, the 80s, if you will.
Yes. Well, when I graduated from Hamline, I was also graduating from my film school, and I was ready for doing an internship. And I found out that this guy named Prince was doing a film. And so I found out where the production studio was, and I called them literally until they knew my name and then they finally just offered me a job to be a production assistant. So I was a production assistant on the film, and then I helped the directors and everything doing gopher work, and I also drove the cast. Then I went back to Japan, and I was an English teacher, which would have made my English teachers throughout my life cringe because I was not the best student. But I learned that by being a teacher, I learned the language better, and it was a really great experience. It really formed the foundation of my career to use English and writing to have it as my fundamental skill. You asked earlier about my career plans. When I studied Asian studies, everybody thought I was crazy because what is your career? And I basically found through experimentation and trying things that's always formed my career.
So you were able to, well, and if you're going to Japan to teach English, so you've got obviously some background in Japanese history and language. So I'm fascinated by, you know, it's kind of surreal that these days to think about traveling to other countries pre-internet. Right? Like there's so many things we take for granted these days. You know, you have Google Maps on your phone, you have translations on your phone. Like it's easier now and than ever to travel the world. I'd love to hear just a moment, like what was that like for, you know, I don't know, 20 something year old Philip coming out of Minnesota and going to Japan and having to navigate something to that at that point was, fairly different from what you were used to.
Yes, I didn't go there as a Japanese speaker, and I was pretty much cut off from anybody except for through writing letters, which is pretty quaint at this point.
Yeah.
And then I think that, you know, through my time in Japan, things like telex started and then fax. And so I started seeing things like computers emerge, and I think that it wasn't so much, you know, me being in Japan as an American, but me being an emergent technologist and just jumping into what was the newest new thing. I think that living abroad and being completely independent of parents and advisors made me fiercely independent and made me very self-reliant. And I think that that's held me in good stead throughout.
Yeah, I'm sure that is quite the leap there, especially all halfway around the world, as they say. So, well, so then, you know, what caused you to come back, or what motivated you to come back from working there? You know, you're learning Japanese, you've got a job, you're kind of figuring things out. Was that always part of the plan to come back, or?
Well, I lived there for 3 years. I lived near Kyoto for the first year, which is just lovely. I love Kyoto. And then I lived in a small town on the Japan Sea, which was also really lovely. And then my third time, I lived in Tokyo. And if you've ever been to Tokyo, there's about 25 million people that live within, I don't know, 100 miles. And so there's a real sense of lack of space. Living in Tokyo is, you know, being on subways with 25 people within 5 feet of you and surrounded by concrete and technology. So that made me want to get back to Minnesota and America just to be able to enjoy the outdoors and be able to have a quality of life that I didn't feel I was getting in Tokyo.
Yeah, but then it sounds like you also got kind of your first taste of tech there. And so that's perhaps a good segue. You come back, you know, and I don't know the exact timing here, but I would love to hear what inspired you to get into tech. And I believe your first job here as creative manager at in tech was working for Fingerhut and helping them, quote unquote, get online, as we said back in the day.
Yes. So I came back to Minnesota and I didn't know what I was going to be able to do. And then I discovered a copywriting job. And so I went to Fingerhut and I walked into this space that was called the creative department. And I had never heard of a creative department. And had I known that, I might have actually had that as my goal. So I started as a copywriter, and immediately this Mac came out, and everybody was able to work using desktop publishing. And soon we were able to, you know, cut out having keyliners and typesetters, and everybody had a computer, and it really upset a lot of people. So it's kind of set up me for being on the wave of technological change. Soon thereafter, this whole internet thing started happening. I heard about Amazon starting, and so I really pushed internally to get an internet presence. And it took me about a year, and we finally built our first internet presence. And then I had to learn about a whole lot of things, like what is an information architecture? What is a homepage? Well, how do you actually develop things that technologically can be developed by people who are not artistic? So that was a time of immense change. I developed my own system of developing information architecture. And also, I had done a lot of branding. So it was a combination of graphic design, branding, copywriting, and really easy to use information architecture.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, and we mentioned Quaint earlier. I mean, those days, I remember these days too. And we won't wax too nostalgic on the 90s here. But, you know, for many of our listeners, it might be hard to picture the web back then. But, you know, there you were working on some of these early e-commerce sites, Fingerhut, and I think Target was perhaps the next one. What are some of the key lessons and inflection points that stand out for you in your early days of working in this space and exploring how your art and your tech come together for you?
In two different ways. One is that initially it was myself as a creative person and a technologist and a marketing person. And I think that that's generally a recipe to fail because you have to start with user experience design and look at what the user needs to do and what's the best way for them to achieve their goals. So when I went to Target, I was given access to a usability lab. And the usability lab allowed me to, say, try things like different wedding registries or whatever and see what's the best practices. And then I would build targets and then I would be able to test it. So the user experience design aspect was what I really learned. And one of my proudest things is that Target was named the top user experience for retail at the time. And that stayed with me through both my artistic and also my technological career.
Well, let's dive into this a little bit more, you know, especially like an engineer like me. You mentioned for people who are maybe not as artistic as others, you know, tease out a little bit more, like what goes into thinking about user experience? Because there's very much a whole quote unquote thing now around it, right? Like there's people who have these job titles explicitly. There's people who think very, you know, deep about user experience. You know, in your mind, how do you kind of bring this forward and make it a repeatable process?
Well, I think that I start with who is going to be using the application or website or even the person in the airport, and what is their why, and then what is the pathway for them to be able to be most successful. Then I am able to get them into a user testing environment and put my theories to test. And, you know, it's not just about graphic design. Actually, I think that you have to be very free in letting whatever you design be maybe wrong. And so I'm in a very much a test and learn mode rather than I know what's right and then we must do this. So I think that the other thing is that when you start looking at things from a user experience design perspective, it is compelling for business cases and for unifying the technology, business, and creative teams to be able to have a shared vision based upon what is the best for the user. For e-commerce, for instance, you want people to be able to get things into a shopping cart very easily. And so that is something that now there's just giant teams who are focused on that. So each time that you're working, even now I'm at a nonprofit, you're looking at what are the basic needs that people need and how can they be most successful. And that will help your business succeed.
What are maybe one or two quick tips that the, you know, the non-UX person might incorporate to just help them get in the, you know, walk a mile in someone else's shoes, as they like to say?
Again, define personas, the people that will be using whatever you're creating, and then design some tests that people can do. It can be even as simple as having coworkers who aren't involved with what you're doing try it. But there are many now online services to allow you to test really affordably. And so I think that those two things would be a great first start.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We'll see if we can link up some resources here. You know, Philip, we've thrown around a few titles now, creative manager, creative director, perhaps step back a little bit for our listeners and describe the role a bit more. Like, what does your day-to-day look like? What are the key skills? You know, you mentioned graphic design. We talked a little bit about usability. Paint the picture, if you will, of what a creative director does and how they work in a company, who they interface with. What does kind of the typical day look like?
Probably isn't a typical day, which is one of the things I enjoy about my career. I ground myself in brand design, which means what is the overall mission, vision of the organization? How do we articulate that? Then what are the design standards? Who is our audience? And then for me, there's an array of elements that I am doing creative direction for, such as copywriting, graphic design, photography, video, website design, app design, and right now I'm putting on a virtual conference for the first time. So I think that being a creative director means that you have to have a really strong understanding of the organization's brand that you're working with, and then be the person that can work with multiple teams to be able to stay within that brand and articulate it successfully with whatever medium that you're working within. I've also kicked off teams. So at Fingerhut and Target, I developed overall teams that included writers and designers and web developers and information architects and project managers, and developed them in a way that some people would be doing the day-to-day communications and some would be doing overall website designs. So you find out what the organization's needs are, and then you design the team to work on that. Also, when I've worked at larger organizations, I've had many technological partners and also creative agency partners to be able to augment my staff. And a lot of times they bring their own boutique experiences and abilities, and so you can use them in a way that really amplifies your team's ability to get the brand out in whatever means that you're working on.
That's so interesting. So how do you, how do you approach kind of the technology and the software question as a tool to incorporate into your work, right? You know, in some ways with a computer, you kind of have this infinite canvas, if you will, upon which you can create most anything virtually, of course. How do you incorporate what the computer is capable of doing into your work as a creative director?
Well, that's such an amazing question. I think that I've been surfing the wave of exponential change. And so the computer I have today is so infinitely better than the one I started with. And apps weren't a thing. And now augmented reality and VR reality are all new things. So often what I'm doing as an explorer is learning what each means of communication are what they are, and then finding through benchmarks who's doing things well, and then honing in on either my artistic point of view or my brand point of view for an organization to use those technological means to achieve our goals. And there are big questions. Sometimes, like, do you need to have a responsive website and an app? Or can a responsive site just be enough? And so, at CaringBridge, we developed an app because apps form deeper relationships than a website. People search and find people on websites, but they're much more loyal on an app. So part of it, too, is really understanding what each technology delivers to the user and then how it amplifies your organization's ability to communicate and allow them to achieve their goals.
Yeah, it's so cool. I kind of think about there's just this infinite number of possibilities. You mentioned CaringBridge in there, and I don't want to go specific into the details of CaringBridge, but having myself just changed into working for a nonprofit, I'd love to hear kind of your perspective on that switch. You know, you've spent a lot of time in e-commerce and now you're at a nonprofit. Reflect for a moment, if you will, on that inflection point that is making that kind of change in your life.
Well, from a design perspective, when you are working at a commerce website, you're looking for the ways to communicate and make transactions to be profitable. And at a nonprofit, at CaringBridge, for instance, we don't sell people's information and we don't have advertising. And so we can prioritize the experience based upon what their needs are. So just to give you an example, if you're at Facebook, for instance, and you say that you have you're getting married, then they'll suddenly start showing you engagement rings. So at CaringBridge, we don't do that type of thing. So it's really a sanctuary that allows people to communicate to their family and friends on a very personal level, but it's all privacy protected and it's all their data. And so the inclination is to make the experience best for them rather than try to figure out how to make a profit from them.
Right. Well, for sure. And for our listeners, CaringBridge is such a critical service these days, especially as we deal with so much of folks who are, end of life, things like that. But also just, Phil, from a career perspective for you like that, was there something in particular motivating you to go to nonprofit, or was it, just, hey, you happened to be right place, right time and knew the person, got recruited in there?
Well, I always look for opportunities where a brand can be revitalized and the user experience can be made better. And so when I started at Schwann's, I thought, oh my goodness, I can really help Schwann's out. And I did the same thing when I started at CaringBridge. But also I fell in love with the vision of no one should go through a health journey alone, and that there are different kinds of brands out there. Like when I worked at Target, everybody loves my Target, And at CaringBridge, we're more of a what is called a love mark, where people have had transformative experiences with their friends and family. And many people absolutely love what we do. And so it's very rewarding in a way that, say, selling more ice cream is not.
Yeah, for sure. I know, in just in my own journey switching to nonprofit, it actually took a little bit of a mindset shift though too. Like, there was motivation to join, but then there was also, like, once you get in there, it was like, oh, there's something way more here than I expected. So yeah, we'll be sure to link up Caring Bridge for our listeners here too. It is a fantastic service. Philip, coming back to kind of the bigger picture here, you know, one of the things I like to ask folks is, you know, tell me a little bit about kind of the pros and cons, if you will, of being in a role like creative director. Not so much about any specific company, but as you look at the arc of being a creative director, what's the best thing about it, best couple of things about it, and what are some of the challenges that you've had to face or overcome in the role?
The things that I love are creating transformative change through brand and creative direction. Some of the challenges are that you have a lot of people who have a lot of opinions, and it's often hard to get everybody to share a common vision. So part of what I always need to do is be able to bring a lot of people along for the ride and keep a unified vision.
How do you, you know, what are some, you know, this is often a theme on this show of communication and building a shared, you know, understanding. What are some perhaps things that you've learned over the years that are helpful in doing that? Because I've seen this out of creative directors as well, right? Like, you put up this visual and people will react to it, and sometimes very viscerally. And then you have to kind of work through all of that feedback. And of course, everybody thinks they're a design expert or a marketing expert. And of course, we all aren't. So how do you practically work through some of those things?
In two fundamental ways. One is, all my work is grounded in data and on finding out how people are using a service, what their psychographic backgrounds are, what their personas are, and using that and usability testing, also using things like analytics of website usage, testing, A/B testing. So everything I do is grounded in testing. And then secondly is, when I was doing brand creative direction for organizations, I develop a benchmark of where the field was to be able to say, hey, you know, everybody, this is an easy explanation, but everybody's blue in your market. Why aren't you orange? And orange means happy. But I'd also always develop, say, three different designs, one being very conservative, one being very traditional, and one being far out. And, you know, having everything kind of line up with a specific vision. And I found that if I have three different visions for an organization, that we can land on one where everybody is happy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, sometimes you just got to limit the choices a little bit, but still have people guided through the experience. Well, so in parallel to your day job, you know, which it's kind of interesting, you have a really creative day job, and then you also have a really creative hobby, or it's probably taken on more than a life, more than the life of a hobby at this point. But, you know, you've established yourself quite nicely as an artist, and I would love for you to take a moment and share how you've built your art career alongside your day job career, because this is really fascinating to me, the way artists often navigate both, you know, quote unquote, putting food on the table, as well as pursuing their passion and their love of art.
Well, as an artist and as a creative director, I love the exploration. I love learning. And within an organization, there are specific roadmaps and goals that you have to do. As an artist, I determine exactly what I want to do and what I want to learn and how I want to get there. So being an artist allows me to explore in a way that being a creative director does not allow me. And so, for instance, when I launched my first website, I used MetaTags really well, and I was able to pounce on good SEO, and I had really great paintings and great stories. And one of my proudest things was I was able to, on Google, be higher than MoMA. So, you know, not only did building my own personal website for my art help me as an artist, but it also helped me as a creative director. And, you know, I've kept on top of different technologies in ways that being a creative director doesn't allow me to. So I've learned, for instance, how to take blur motion photography and then apply those images onto acrylic and then light them up with LEDs and make massive art installations. So I could not have done that through my day job. And it's in that exploration of the changing technology and being able to apply it that makes me very excited. You know, there's just so much change. So when I started doing light artwork, fluorescent lights were big. Now I can do LED lights and they can last for 50 years and not be hot and not be energy absorbers. So the aspect of being an artist lets me explore my content, my vision, and always be on the cusp of change. And I've gone through from being a potter to being an oil painter to being a 3D oil painter when you wear chroma depth glasses, my paintings are actually 3D, to being a light artist, and now I'm working on VR and creating immersive experiences. And that ability to be able to ride this wave of technological change as an artist has been deeply satisfying. The other aspect is you say about, you know, like the day job versus the being an artist. I find that making art makes me happy and it brings me a sense of joy. There's this whole idea of flow. And when I'm, say, in VR and painting in voxels, which are X, Y, Z coordinate elements, I can be in there for 3 hours and be absolutely in rapture. And so that's one of the things that people who are artists can experience, or musicians, or even comedians. But that's my way to feel a sense of joy. And it's not work. It's just a passion that I'm able to realize.
Yeah, and that's so cool. I mean, I love that. I like that notion of flow. I know even as myself, one of the things I've been learning to do as an adult is draw. And I've even in practicing and going through the examples, I'd noticed all of a sudden there's an hour gone, right? And you just feel like you're in this state of flow, even at my basic level. So I can't imagine what it's like when you're an accomplished artist like yourself.
Flow has actually been used, you know, by the Navy SEALs. And how do you coordinate teams to all be in the same flow? There's a whole science behind it, and I've just, you know, blundered into it myself. And then when I've studied, you know, the flow genome and so on, it's what I do. So it was kind of a happy happenstance.
Yeah. Is there anything in particular for our listeners that they could take away that helps you get into that state of flow when it comes to creating?
Well, I think that there's a part of us that is judgmental, where we're saying things are right or wrong. And many people come up to me and say, you know, I like making art, but I'm not very good. And so I eliminate the judgment. I just don't care if it's good or bad, because I'm making makes me happy. And so I think getting beyond judging and getting into a flow state is really important. And so for me, it's listening to music that I love and not judging what I'm doing and seeing where I go and realizing, just like with being a creative director and test and learn, you just try and see what happens, and there's no right or wrong. I mean, if you would show a piece of pottery from Japan that's shigaraki, that's really rough-hewn, Americans would say that's ugly, and it's probably very expensive in Japan. Or somebody looked at a Picasso and said, oh, God, that he wasn't very realistic. So I think don't judge. Find your own beauty, and that's what I do.
That's amazing. Well, you know, it's interesting as you're describing the state of flow and kind of your work principles. I bet many of my developer listeners out there will actually recognize that what I've experienced when I'm coding and especially when I'm coding and I know like what I need to do and how I want to do it. And it all comes together. And so there's this very much, and then next thing you know, you've cranked out, you know, your whole application, or you've solved some of your hardest problems. And so I can very much relate to that state of flow.
Absolutely. And I think that part of it is time management, because, you know, if you look at the average usage of a mobile phone, people are using them in micro sessions of under 15 seconds and multiple times in an hour. And so part of the key is to be able to break free of all the distractions and kind of go into a deep think mode where you're able to have like maybe more like theta waves than alpha waves in your brain, and therefore you're able to go deeper and faster because you're really concentrated without distractions.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I couldn't agree more. It reminds me of one of books I read recently called Deep Work by Cal Newport, where he talks a lot about how to set up and remove distractions so that you can actually get into a much deeper state.
Philip, one of the things I really love about VR is that it is an immersive environment, and you are shutting everything out, and it actually is allowing for better training, better pain management for hospitals, and so there's a whole kind of emerging science on what emergent technologies like VR are doing in a positive light.
Yeah, I was just, you know, you it's almost like you read my mind here, because I was going to ask you about the VR side of the equation. Describe a little bit more, like, what and how you do art in VR, like, you know, what kind of setup do you have, and what's the state of VR as a technology for creating art?
The state of technology for creating art is definitely in flux, and people in the consumer side are barely aware of all the improvements that are happening. It's very much a B2B gamer kind of market at this point. The technology is changing very rapidly, and consumer adoption is happening fast and faster. When I set up my VR, I have a gaming PC and a headset that cost about $3,000, but it has the horsepower I need to be able to create a 20-room experience. Now, Oculus or Facebook has put out a headset that's only $299. And so that should really increase adoption. I'd say that this era right now is like the flip phone before the iPhone arrived. Mm-hmm. And in about 2 years, the iPhone or, you know, headsets that are either augmented or VR will be much more available. The big thing is, like, when I talk about having a PC and a cord and a headset, that's really prohibitive. But with 5G and faster computing chips being emergent, it'll be less and less needing to be plugged into a PC to be able to do the heavy computing, and you'll be able to have lighter and lighter headsets that will actually look pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's pretty exciting. I'm constantly amazed at what's kind of on just over the horizon. Any thoughts on, you know, if somebody's interested in that space, where's a good place for them to get started with VR or AR, as they're called?
Well, for VR, I would get myself a set of Oculus, and it's not that expensive, and just plug in and do something like Beat Saber or some of the other kinds of, like, Google Earth is one of my favorites, where you can travel around the world. Really nice at this time when you can't travel and you love traveling. So I can fly to Kyoto literally fly to Kyoto or Paris. So I would start with getting a set of Oculus headsets.
Yeah. I'm curious to your take too. I think one of the other things you've been seeing emergent in the art space is the use of, you know, artificial intelligence, for lack of a better phrase, machine learning, et cetera, in the sense that having computer aided design or computer generated art. What are your thoughts on how one might use artificial intelligence or any of those kinds of things as part of creating art?
That's a very fascinating question. I think that AI gets a lot of bad rap by many people, but it's also really an enabler. And so I think that, like, as somebody experiences an art installation, that it might learn from you and be able to provide you a even better experience as you go through it. I honestly don't dabble a lot in AI. I'm much more interested in VR and AR. I think that with AR, I can give you an example of Night Sky, which you can download on your phone, and it has a map wherever you are in the world of the entire solar system around us, and it identifies every single star. So, you know, that type of thing is really important. And I think that retailers are starting to use AI or AR, and it's an expansion of our ability to kind of take the physical space and be able to make it much more of a visual space using vehicles like the phone.
Yeah, it's so true. And that is such a cool app too, by the way.
Isn't it cool? I love the stars, and I've been like in places where I didn't know what the stars were, and it just is so easy.
Yeah, no doubt. Philip, can bring in this home, you know, for those in our audience who want to go down this path of combining art and tech, what advice would you give them for getting started or learning some of the lessons that you've learned through your years?
I say be a lifelong learner. Don't wait for somebody to teach you something. Just figure it out. There's so many easy ways to self-teach. I think that if you're an artist, just go with it and make what makes you happy. Don't worry about the commercial side. Don't worry, but just make what makes you happy. From a industry standpoint for technology, get out and see what other people are doing, and then position yourself so you are on the crest of the wave of change. And that's, you're not going to find it in textbooks, or you're going to find it by real life means. So I think that a lot of it is coming down to self-reliance and just learning.
Yeah.
How I've operated my entire career. I've never, I always became what I was going to get a new job title by what I was doing, rather than waiting for somebody to give me creative director job title.
I was going to say, this kind of harkens back to going off to Japan and having to be self-reliant. So it feels like it all comes back and ties together.
It does.
Yeah. Philip, so amazing to have you on this show here. And for our listeners, do go check out Philip's website. Real quick, Philip, you know, mentioned the website. Where can our listeners best connect with you, see your art perhaps, or at least get a taste of the work you do?
Well, I have a website, philipnoyad.com. I have a Facebook site that's also Philip Noyad, and an Instagram that's Philip Noyad, and a YouTube that's Philip Noyad. So if you just look me up on Google, you'll find all sorts of articles and all sorts of places where my art is showing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And for our listeners, as always, we'll link those up in the show notes. Philip, so awesome to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1, make a donation via Patreon. 2, if you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3, buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.